Hello and welcome. The Portavoot Institute for the Study of the Iranian World welcomes you to another episode of our podcast, Legacies of Ancient Persia. Join us as we further explore the many legacies of ancient Persia and its relevance to global patrimony. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Legacies of Ancient Persia. This week, our guest is Dr. Robert Rollinger, a professor of ancient history and ancient Near Eastern studies at the University of Innsbruck. In this episode, we discuss deconstructing Eurocentrism as a crucial component of understanding ancient cross-cultural interactions, what made an empire in antiquity, and explore the state of both Achaemenid and ancient studies today. We hope you enjoy this episode, and if you like what you hear, please give our show a 5-star rating and review us on Apple or Spotify. Great. Well, thank you so much for joining me this morning, or evening for you. I want to start us off and ask you, when did you first discover your passion for ancient history?
Oh my God, this is actually long ago. I was always interested in history in general. There was not any specific epochs that attracted my interest, but I would say already as a teenager, I was amazed in historical topics. Of course, starting first with more contemporary history of the 20th century, but then I was slowly moving back just to understand things better. And it ended up in antiquity. And it was also a combination of history as such and ancient languages, which focused my interest. And yes, so when I had to decide what to study, ancient history was already on my focus, but also the broader area of what we nowadays call the ancient Near East, the more ancient cultures. And from the very beginning, I was fascinated in transcultural contexts, I would say, transcultural relationships. So that started actually very, very early.
And I obviously it's different in Europe than it is here in the States, but was it easy for you to find a program that you felt that fit your interests, or did you have to approach the field sort of in a roundabout way, the way a lot of us did?
I would say in a more roundabout way. There was no specific planning, I started studying in Innsbruck and I just grasped what was offered there, So I did not really think about any specifics. So I just took what was offered there. Innsbruck had the advantage and still has the advantage that it has a very broad offer in humanities, also in ancient languages. So, and actually I took everything I could, and at that very early stage, I was not aware that this is a unique chance to do it, because the older you get, the less possibilities you have really to learn new languages and new stuff. And I'm very happy that I did this from the very beginning.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a great opportunity since you, as you just mentioned, you had a lot of different opportunities that you were able to take advantage of. And so because you had what sounds like a lot of varied interests and because there were so many options, how did you go about narrowing that down to what you would eventually do your PhD in and later research? I mean, was that hard?
Yeah, no, it was not hard at all. I always took the time of studying as a huge opportunity, as I already mentioned, to get what I could get. And actually, it was always somehow in between what you would call classics, that is especially Greek history and ancient Eastern history. And I could never really decide what should be the main focus, and I always combined both of them in a very intensive way, I have to say. And that then ended up in my master thesis, which combined both perspectives when I dealt with Herodotus' Babylonian Logos. So this was for me the perfect combination. Actually, I was offered this topic by my teacher in ancient history, Reinhold Bichler, with whom I had an excellent relationship and to whom I owe very much, also in my historical thinking and in my historical understanding. And he saw that, obviously, that there is someone who could deal with this topic from different angles, combining, let's say, different foci from the classics on the one hand, but also from the ancient East on the other hand. And that's just how it started,
And obviously, I know what you work on now, but for everyone else, a lot of people when they choose a subject, a region, an area, or are interested in sort of cross-cultural contexts, I don't know if people realize, okay, I want to start in one and then I try to go beyond and look from that perspective, or whether they start and try to look at everything and pare it down from there. And so this idea of cross-culture interaction obviously means people are going everywhere, right? In the ancient world, crossing borders and whatnot. So, for you, how do you approach intercultural relationships?
Yeah, actually, you're hitting a very important point, because in my early days, if I may say so, of course, my approach was somehow still very very Eurocentric, but I did not realize this at this moment that it was Eurocentric. It was Eurocentric in the sense that I always didn't understand why white scholars and curricula at the universities start history with ancient Greece as the beginning of Europe, all this kind of stuff. And I was always I always had my problems with this, and I wanted to integrate a larger picture, to integrate the ancient Near East as a historical environment that of course had huge impact and influence on the Greek worlds, and thus also on Europe. But of course, with this specific focus, it was also a Eurocentric perspective, because then everything did not start with the ancient Greece, you may say, but it started with the ancient East, So the problems of this approach I became only aware of, really aware of, in the last 15 years, I would say, when I tried to develop a really more globalized perspective on ancient history, that were still, let's say, what we call the ancient Near East looms large on the one hand, but not in that way that we have to look only to the West, but we have to look in all directions. So you may call it developing a much more Afro-Eurasian perspective. So the interconnectedness of this large landmass that our continents of Asia, Europe, and Africa constitute. So that's, I think, this is also the much more appropriate way how we should do it in nowadays. And you never stop further developing, and you never stop changing your perspectives and your approaches. I think this is also very, very important.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a great point to make. And I'm curious, being in Europe now and seeing a lot of students come through and what's going on, do you feel that this situation has gotten better and that people are taking a much more broad approach to it and trying to decenter Greece and Rome?
Oh yes, definitely. Definitely. So what I experience when I'm teaching, but not only in Innsbruck, but I would say in general in European universities, but I would also include U.S. American university, I see, that the younger generation is entirely aware of the fact that they are living in a globalized world, in a multicultural, multi-regional, connected world. And actually, in my experience, it is very easy to attract the attention of younger students in dealing with proto-globalized and with proto-globalized antiquities in the pluralis, and I do not think that this is very difficult. To the contrary, there is a wonderful layer, let's call it that way, of interest for such an approach.
And I mean, it's great that it's getting better. And definitely, I think I see and hear more stories of people being able to really decenter just Greece and Rome. Although I haven't noticed that this really significantly extends to like proper programs for Iranian studies, or, there's not a lot of places that are like, yes, I will come here and you can study ancient Persia alone. You still kind of have to go through classics or somewhere else. And my classics program, which I came through, I graduated in 2018 from undergrad. Like, I didn't get one single class that offered me anything on the Persians. I got them through our Greek warfare class or something, and it was kind of disappointing. And so I'm wondering, how do we fix this? Like, is there something we can do to make it better? Because there are so many people out there who are fascinated by the Persians, and especially the Achaemenids. So, like, why is it that we just can't get, is it a problem of like not available professors or something else?
I think teachers, professors are also important elements, you know, in demonstrating what is important and how we should approach history, how we should deal with our sources. Of course, this is a very, very important aspect. I think you are absolutely right in this. Another issue is, of course, the fact, you know, that this kind of focusing on classics and the importance of classics is still a part of our tradition, especially at the universities, you know, when universities, or let's say when classics were established at Western universities in the 19th century. So nearly everybody was convinced of course classics is important because it's the basis for all our culture, you know, and of course this you cannot overcome in just one decade, and actually you also should not overcome it entirely because classics is still important. Nobody would deny it, but the problem is if you see it just in an isolated way, and if you do not, let's say, put classical cultures, be it Greek culture, be it Roman culture, in its natural setting and environment, in its natural transcultural context. I think this is the point, you know. So not entirely, or let's say that way, we should, of course, not get rid of this, but we should focus on it in a new way and integrate it into a larger context and into a larger perspective. I think that's the point.
Yeah, no, definitely very, very valid points. So speaking a little bit of, you know, you can't ignore classics, they do play an important role in helping us expand beyond. I know that a lot of your work has gone into contact between the Aegean and the ancient Near East and some of these other things. So can you tell us a little bit about what these contacts would have looked like? Was it just trade? Was there more?
No, this is actually, it took place on all levels you can imagine, you know. So you have to imagine that the ancient East is the region where you have the first real empires in world history, with its heyday in the times of the Achaemenid Persian Empire, where you have a state that reaches from nowadays Central Asia, Afghanistan to the Levant. And then you have on the other side the Greek city-states, so minor states, who are looking at this huge empire and its huge cultural development, its richness. And of course, you have different layers of contact. You may call it influence, but I think the much better term is impact, because impact also includes different kinds of reaction. It includes adopting things, you know, like, for example, the Greeks adopted the alphabet from the Phoenicians of the Levant. They adopted the idea of monumental building, of monumental statues, of literary issues. You know, it is absolutely clear that the Iliad is somehow dependent on the Gilgamesh epic. So there is a huge amount of context, but these contexts do not mean that the Westerners, the Greeks, did just copy things. You know, they faced a high culture, which was amazing for them. And of course, they made something new out of it, you know. But this would not have happened if this ancient Eastern cultures, empires, worlds would not have existed. So that's what I would call impact. But this impact also includes other issues. And of course, you know, if you get in touch with these larger worlds, you start to pose some fundamental questions. Who I am? What is my identity as opposed to this huge empire? What are the values that we have to stick at? Because these ancient Eastern empires, of course, have a whole set of values, of religions, of belief systems, you know, and this creates thinking. This creates the shaping of identities. And these identities can take different paths. Of course, they can be shaped in a way of a total difference towards the empire. So we are the Greeks and these are the barbarians, you know. But although this kind, or let's say this process can only happen if there is the other one. if the ancient Eastern world would not have been there, you know, there would not be a Greek identity, actually, as opposed to the other world. So this is a very, very complex or dynamic process, or better in the plural, processes that are going to take place. And I think it is still a major task of the modern historical disciplines to unravel this kind of entanglement and the reactions and counter-reactions that happen. So it's actually it's the absolutely the same that we are facing nowadays. You know, it's only, yes, we live in an entangled, multicultural, interconnected world. On the one hand, this is absolutely clear, also for students of our days who have these larger visions. But we also have our regional identities, also, and again in the pluralis. And also these regional identities are related to this larger picture, and they would not have come into existence without this globalized world. So this is a very fascinating, let's say, process of action and counteraction, something that is not very specific to the ancient worlds, but that is a general human setting, you know, that we are facing nowadays, as the ancient Greeks faced it 2,500 years ago.
Yeah, well, I find, you know, these sort of intercultural relationships fascinating. And, you know, one thing that struck me actually as you were talking that I would love for you to be able to detail for us, because I don't think that I've ever asked this question on the show before. But as someone who has studied the history of like world empires as well, I think this makes you the perfect person to ask, you know, what constituted, like, what made something in the ancient world truly an empire? We've had a lot of people say that, you know, the ancient Persians created the first world empire, but we don't really know exactly what that would have looked like or what that means in the ancient context. So can you tell us, you know, what makes something an empire?
There's a huge debate about this, you know, and it is not the case that you can just, you know, open encyclopedia and reading three chapters and then you know what an empire is. But of course, we have to define what we think an empire is, and there are some commonalities, I would say, that are shared by modern scholarship. So on the one hand, I would say that empires, or the empires of the ancient East, they have a prehistory, of course, you know, a long chain of prehistory. So let's say from city-states that come into being already in the fourth millennium BC to territorial states, competing territorial states who partly cover huge areas. And for some of these territorial states, you may even discuss, is this an empire or not? But with the first millennium BCE, empire was established in a way that it never disappeared again, you know, until nowadays. So there is a sequence, let's say, from the first empire of the first millennium BC, that is the Neo-Assyrian Empire, until imperial history nowadays. And of course, if we look at this date, there are important things that we have to mention that are characteristic of this kind of imperial state formations. They are not national states like we are used to face nowadays. They are multi-ethnic and multilingual. They do not have definite borderlines like modern states. You know, when you cross a certain area and you exactly know, no, I'm leaving this state and now I'm entering another one. They have borderlands, and these borderlands are very dynamic, I would like to stress, because these empires also have a very specific ideology. They somehow develop the idea that they rule the whole world. Of course, this world is more an imagination than it is reality, but it is an important ideology. So the king or the ruler of this empire is exactly the ruler of the whole world, and he is also somehow a conqueror. So that's why waging war plays a crucial role for empires. And they are expanding, you know, they are entering new areas and new regions. And you can already observe this kind of development in the sequence from the Neo-Assyrian, Neo-Babylonian to the Achaemenid Persian Empire, of this kind of expansion, including new areas that are conquered and that are dealt with in different ways. So you have, let's say, you have areas that are put under direct control. We would call it establishing a province with a governor and so on. Then you have an outer ring let's say the local princes are still left in power, but they are dealt as vassals. You know, they have to pay tribute, and it is clear that they have somehow to obey to the imperial center. And then you have areas outside, and these areas outside are still somehow deeply interconnected with the empire, because empires in ancient times and in more recent times, they have what I would call an imperial reach. These are areas where an imperial army is able to move in, and this goes far beyond actually the areas that are under direct control of the empire, just to show I can do it, you know. We are there. We are really rulers of the world. So this is a whole set of elements that are that can be observed from the very beginning onwards. And that's also one reason, if I may mention this, why I do not very much appreciate the distinction, or let's say the term modern and pre-modern. You know, because this term, it is very common, as you know. People speak about pre-modern worlds and modern worlds, but there is actually, in my opinion at least, no satisfying definition that really makes such a division possible. Because, of course, in more recent times, things are accelerating, they have a larger dynamics, but the central elements, in my opinion at least, they are still the same. And if you know, talk about complexity, of course, and if you still want to hold to this distinction between modern and pre-modern, you even become problems how you define what we call, or what is generally called, the modern world. Is it the 18th century, the 19th, the 20th, or is it just the last 3 decades? You know, there the problem starts. So, and I think, in my opinion, this division is in many cases just an excuse to ignore more ancient worlds. And it is not, it doesn't hit reality, in my opinion. And history is a much larger area, and the ancient worlds are an important element of it. And I think they have to be included. And especially for this question, what empires are, how empires matter, which role do empires play in world history? The ancient worlds have such a huge amount of examples to offer. To include it is just crazy, and I cannot understand it.
Yeah, no, you make some really valid points. And thank you for sort of breaking down the complicated issues around what is an empire. I don't think that I've really given it much thought, but that's just because, well, we're told one thing and then you sort of take it as, okay, cool, and then you move on. So I love that there's a lot of more deep thought into it. And one of the things that struck me as you were speaking was, you know, at a time, and I'm pulling on my classics background here, but when you study the history of the Greek world, and then you do hit the Persian Wars period, and then you hit Athens building what people call is the Athenian Empire, with basically the Delian League. And based on what you were talking about, I'm curious, I think it's a topic of some contention somewhere. Was Athens in its height and its with the Delian League, could it be considered an actual empire? Because some people say ancient Athens was an empire and some people don't.
Yes, of course. You can doubt it and you can question it. I think it has elements of an empire. So it starts with the reach, you know. If you think about, you know, from Sicily to Egypt, to the Levant, to the Aegean, so it had a huge reach, you know. It had really an imperial aspiration, and I would, as I would say it, you know, it had a strong military component. So waging war all the time perfectly fits, you know, to the Athenian Empire. And it also shows something which is very important, that the term empire is not, let's say, reduced to a specific system of rule, that is autocracy or monarchy. So a democracy can also be an empire. So this is not an exception. You may ask, or you may suggest whether it was a short-term empire, you know, because actually it didn't last so long. But I think it really had imperial connotation, and I am perfectly fine in calling it an empire.
I mean, as to the sort of imperial aspirations, I mean, does it matter that it seemed like, yes, Athens, when what they were building is really wanted to control, you know, the islands and the Aegean and obviously the colonies of Asia Minor. But I don't remember learning or hearing that, you know, they wanted to go further into Anatolia, into Persia, in down to Egypt. So just to kind of clear this up, I mean, is that enough essentially if you just want to have control of sort of Greece and the Aegean, or and not kind of push onward, or, you know, how does that change the calculus?
No, of course they were also pushing onward. You know, if you just look, you know, about the interventions of the Athenian fleet in the Levant, in Egypt, if you look at the intervention of the Athenians in Sicily, so there was really an imperial aspiration, you know, and also an entire awareness that to keep on going with this system, they needed the tributes, you know, and their allies were actually not really allies because they were somehow minor states that had to obey the command of Athens. And if they did not obey, you know, the sanctions were harsh. You know, they ended up in executions, they ended up in deportations, they ended up in establishing Athenian colonies on different islands. So the counter-reactions were imperial in true sense, I would say, and that perfectly fits in what we see in ancient Eastern Empire. The point, in my opinion, why modern scholarship sometimes has problems in defining the Athenian or the Delian League as an empire is an element of evaluation, or let's say an element of qualifying states, in the sense that for many scholars or for many people, also nowadays, the term empire has a negative element. You know, the empires are aggressive, they are always waging war, you know, they are tyrannies and so on. And this is somehow in contradiction to a very positive connotation of Athenian history as the birthplace of democracy, and so on. So there is this element as well, and I think this plays somehow a role in whether scholars are really willing also to qualify the Delian League as the Athenian Empire or not. But focusing on the structural level, I think it is an empire. And actually, if I may mention this, the same is somehow true with the United States of America. Of course, the United States of America, they have the awareness that their independence was won in a fight against an empire, that is the British Empire. And of course, then you draw the conclusion, of course, it means that the new state is not an empire, you know. But if you look, let's say, if you have, in my opinion at least, a clear-cut look at the history of the United States from its established to nowadays, it's, for me, there is no question that it has all elements of an empire.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for that. It's really fascinating. Now, I want to kind of pick up on something that you mentioned, which was, you know, so you can think of it as an empire, even though it was, you know, technically democracy with air quotes on it. And so, you know, that got me thinking, empire, okay, can that structure work with pretty much any government type? Or is there a government type that wouldn't really sort of work?
No, I think so. It can work with any kind of government type. I think so, yes. I think it's really not dependent on the specific government type. If you accept this, of course, then it's easier to qualify the Delian League as an Athenian empire, you know, or also the United States as an empire. But I think this is contested, of course, somehow. But I think if you have a clear-cut structural look, then I think, yes.
Well, and then thinking sort of really going back to the Persian Empire a little bit, because the land was so vast, and I know obviously you have the Persian king in charge, but obviously it's hard and you can't control all of the massive pieces of land. So I do know that they left certain places, right, kind of governing themselves, but they sort of bow down to the overlord. So I'm curious, I mean, just in terms of empire and governmental structure, I'm curious to know, like, would it be fair to call at least like the Achaemenid Empire, sort of, did it function in like a sort of confederate monarchy type of style?
I don't think that it's a confederation in the modern sense of the term, but I would say for the imperial center, two things were important. The first one is that subjects were paying tribute, or you may say may pay taxes. So on the one hand, and on the other hand, that they accepted the king or the great king as the center of the universe and their legal overlord. I think if this was fine, these two elements, then specific regions could face some kind of autonomy. And this actually is somehow natural. If you think about this vast mass of land, and of course, it wouldn't have worked otherwise if local governors, they are called satraps, if these local governors wouldn't have had some kind of local agenda that they could manage local issues. And that's absolutely evident. But the center was there. The center was eagerly observing what was going on in the provinces. The center was eagerly observing that the locals all over the empire were paying their taxes and tributes, and also, let's say, paying reference to the great king, and also in public life showing their acceptance and their willingness to be part of this huge empire. We call this ideology and propaganda, of course, this kind of ritualized acceptance of rulership of the great king. But this is how states function. And this is true for the ancient ones and for the more recent ones as well.
Well, I mean, just considering how much I feel that I still have to learn about the Achaemenids and just Persia in general. And you know, I'm sure there's other people out there who also go, you know, oh, I learned something new. This is so interesting. I never thought about it this way. But I want to turn a little bit to, for those of us who would like to do that, you know, and find more ways of learning more. I'm curious to know, you know, in your opinion, considering the fact that through our conversation, you know, you've been able to relate so much of the ancient world and the ancient history to the modern world, which is a huge thing, because I think it helps people relate when they can make connections between ancient and modern. So we can study them in isolation. We can try to study them together. So, you know, in your opinion, what is this, like, the state of studying the Achaemenids now?
Yeah, I would say in general, we should never study ancient history completely isolated, you know. If we study it isolated, it's somehow it's even useless, you know. So this is a huge challenge for ancient historians, I think, that they always, at least in my opinion, have to be aware of a larger context. And this larger context starts with antiquity, of course, but reaches until our very recent times. And it is also an important issue that if you want to have antiquity or ancient history relevant, then you have to place it into a larger context. And in this larger context, contemporary history is a part. It's a part of our lives. And I really think that also modern, very recent political problems, issues of all different kinds, you cannot understand them really without an historical context. And this historical context reaches back into times of antiquities, actually. So you have to have these connections. And I think you have to teach the students in an appropriate way that this is really something which is important. So not to draw them into a splendid isolation, but showing them how important ancient worlds are to understand modern problems, modern political issues. And I do not want to say that it is especially the Achaemenid Empire that matters. This is not true at all. It is my field of research or my major field of research. I think this is true for antiquity in general. It is true for all historical periods. And of course, let's say one single scholar cannot do this alone. This is absolutely clear. But the solution is that we have to engage in transdisciplinary research, that we have to cooperate, that we have to work together, and that from the very beginning onwards, we have to show our students that this is absolutely necessary. But it's also absolutely fascinating, because only with this kind of scholarly exchange within antiquities, but also beyond, you get the larger picture. And this larger picture is the fact that matters, you know, not a specific epoch. So I know, of course, that any disciplines has somehow the inclination to show this is the most important one. This is absolutely, this is, you know, but I think what matters is this kind of connection, this kind of entanglement of disciplines. You may label it this way, and especially antiquities and contemporary history, they are interrelated. And I'm really convinced, you know, this, of course, let's take the Achaemenid Persian Empire. So this happened, let's say, 2,500 years ago. In human history, in my opinion, 2,500 years is nothing, you know. It's a short time. It's not a deep history, you know. This is not so long ago. So, and this is also important to realize.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think one of the resources I hope will become pretty big for people who want to read more, learn more, is the result of the workshop that we had here last year. So would you tell our audience, what did you help organize, and why is this so exciting for people who may want to learn more?
Yes, what you are talking about are these, what we call now the Achaemenid workshop. Let's say that is a larger project or undertaking that was established by my friend Raim Shayegan and myself, especially for the reasons I have just been mentioning, that when modern scholarship is dealing with what we call Achaemenid history, this has to happen on a completely new level. It has to happen in a transdisciplinary context where scholars of different disciplines are cooperating, are exchanging opinions. But it is not only the context of scholars that matters, but it has to integrate the students from the very beginning to show the students, on the one hand, how important this kind of transdisciplinary research is, and on the other hand, the fascination this kind of transdisciplinary research has. For the Achaemenid Persian Empire, there is one thing which is especially complicated, I have to say, and that's the fact that due to the fact of its huge extension and its including so many different regions, peoples, and languages, we have quite an extended amount of different source languages that are important sources for the history of the empire. And of course, nobody is able to master all these source languages. There is still a huge importance of classical sources, so Greek and Roman sources, and Latin sources, actually. But we have Babylonian sources, we have Egyptian sources, we have Lydian sources, we have Phrygian sources, we have Old Persian sources, we have Elamite sources, we have Aramean sources. So all these kind of different languages. And of course, you need for each of these, not only for each of these languages, but for any kind of special source material, you need a specialist. But it is somehow worthless. It's a little bit an exaggeration, but I'm exaggerating to make it clear. If you just only deal with this specific source, a corpus of source, but you have to integrate this source into the larger picture. And this larger picture you only get in cooperation, in exchanging opinions, in developing, let's say, common methodological yardsticks, how to approach the contexts they have to be included. This is a challenge, of course, it is a major challenge, but it is also fascinating because it shows the complexity of things, it shows how deeply things are interrelated. But of course, you only understand this kind of entanglement if you open your eyes and see the larger picture. I think that's the point. And this Achaemenid workshops are thought to be a platform for this kind of exchange of scholars who are interested in this kind of Achaemenid history in the next decade, so to say, but at the very same time, attracting students into this undertaking, showing them this kind of fascinating interrelated research in a transdisciplinary way. And you may even say pathing, or let's say establishing the path for future research and a new approach on this fascinating empire.
And so at the conclusion of each workshop, each individual one, but also at the conclusion of the series, you know, what is it that you hope to produce? Is it just, you know, individual volumes with the papers presented, you know, basically for the general public? Is this going to be something accessible to them that they can pick up, or is this more for students and scholars?
I think it is both. You know, it is on the one hand, of course, I do not have to mention this especially, but of course, publications matter. You know, this is clear. This is not only They are not only important for our peers, but they are important as for students who are studying the subject. But at the very same time, they give a home, these workshops, for PhD students who are working on the subject, you know? So these PhD students are not anymore isolated, but they get the offer of an international scholarship that is already interrelated, that poses questions in the same direction. So this kind of, let's say, of double approach, scholarly on the one hand, but also a teaching and including students, advanced students, more advanced ones and less advanced ones, and also showing them the fascination of this kind of approach, I think this goes hand in hand. So this is something you cannot really distinguish. You know, it's something that really belongs together. And also, you know, that very podcast we are now doing, you and me, I think this is also a major task of a kind of outreach and explaining an interested public what we are doing and why we are doing this, and the fascinating aspects of this kind of approach.
Yeah, well, I agree. You know, the publications are very important. You know, they help lay good groundwork for the future of the field. But I'm wondering, yeah, in your opinion, like, what other potentially multimedia or just non-traditional ways do you think we can help people get more involved with, you know, learning more about the Achaemenids, the rest of the, you know, the different Persian empires and stuff?
You know, you are touching a very important point. That's what we call, of course, nowadays when we are creating huge projects, the public outreach, you know, and I think somehow we have to imagine this public outreach like different cascades, you know. So of course, at the beginning there must be a serious, highly qualified scholarly research, you know. But of course, it cannot end in just producing our papers in renowned journals and series. So there needs also in this context to be established a larger context. That is the podcasts we have imagined, YouTube channels, you know, discussion with students, interviews, of course, also an outreach in newspapers and this kind of publications that have a reach towards a broader public. So, but this is, of course, something that cannot happen, you know, or that cannot change opinions within 2 or 3 years. This is also a larger process. But we have to be aware about the different steps of these cascades, as I have been imagining this kind of larger work. And of course, you're absolutely right. It's not only the scholars and the students. It's a general public that has to be involved as well. And yeah, no, I cannot agree more.
I mean, I love that you brought up the idea of maybe more academically focused YouTube channels. Perhaps some scholars would do it. I know, obviously, time is an issue, so it's hard to get scholars to do it. But maybe or have a non-scholar, but who is informed by scholarly research, would be definitely a way. Because I think that, you know, it's time, and it's time that we. It says something about the field and about our failure, all of our collective failures. I think that the, you know, a lot of students' points of entry nowadays is the 300 films or something terrible. And so, yeah, we definitely have to do a better job of sort of meeting people where they're coming to the material. So I hope to see more.
You know, when you say you have been mentioning 300s and you said terrible, it is terrible, yes, but also no. Because it gives us also the opportunity to talk about this issue. You know, where do these kind of perspectives originate? Why are they so strong? You know, in which context have they been created, and so on? So this creates a kind of awareness. And also, you know, another aspect you have been somehow mentioning, it is that I think this dialogue we have been talking about between, let's say, advanced scholars, university professors, and students, PhD candidates, it is also important because we are living in times of very rapid changes, of course, and I would say where every 5 to 10 years, new kind of media are popping up, and each generation is somehow using and appreciating a different kind of media. And also to develop really a specialized and very professional outreach, we need this dialogue between the different generations of scholars and of students, and to see, you know, which are the media that are important for specific questions, and why are they important? So this should not be a petrified system, but a dynamic one, a very flexible one, of course, that uses different channels of communications for different interests, for different generations. And that's I think the only way for this kind of diversified approach into different multipolar directions, where we can really develop, or let's say where we can create, or where we can reach and attract a broader public that is interested in what we are doing.
Yeah, well, I am wholeheartedly on board with every new medium. I hope someone jumps on it. I mean, I guess we're to the point where I guess the youngest generations, they probably would want some sort of ancient Persia TikTok. And I am not the person to do that. But you know what? If someone would like to do that.
Yes, me neither.
If someone wants to do it, please do. I think it would be quite popular. I know.
Yes, and we have to include them, you know, we have to include them. We have to break down walls and we have to see, okay, there's a specific need from a specific generation, and then we have to accept this and work on that, you know. So also we have to be open-minded as well on this kind of diversified medial approaches, I think.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. So I would love to be able to sit here and ask you a ton more questions, but unfortunately, you know, I think that you and I would have grown quite old before we got through all of the questions I have. So instead,
interested in learning more about the wonders of ancient Persia? Visit the UCLA Archaeological Gazetteer of Iran. The Gazetteer digitally preserves famous locations, world heritage sites, and lesser-known areas from all time periods of ancient Iranian history. You can explore using the interactive map, or visit the encyclopedic catalog for updates to the ever-growing list of archaeological sites. Visit www.irangazetteer.ucla.edu and learn more about what the Archaeological Gazetteer of Iran has to offer.
At the end of each podcast episode, I leave guests and our audience with two questions. So the first question I wanted to ask you is, you know, what in your opinion is the greatest legacy left to us from ancient Persia?
There are many, of course, but I think that that one of the legacies that you have for the first time in world history, you have an empire that really covers three modern continents, that is Africa, Europe, and Asia. You have an empire that a multicultural, multi-ethnic empire that worked quite well for 220 years, and that somehow didn't stop to exist even after it was destroyed, because it was through the different periods of time, it was also always a point of reference in a negative, but also in a positive way. So we want to do it the same way, or we want to do it in a completely different other way. It was important for the establishment of identities in the Greeks' worlds, but also in the long durée of European identities. So I think there is a direct relationship, and it is a huge basin, or let's say a transfer channel, where ideas, concepts, plants, domesticates from Central Asia, from Southeast Asia, from East Asia, moved to the West, to the Mediterranean. And this is one of the most important, let's say, processes we are facing in the history of antiquities.
Yeah, no, that's a great answer. And so the second question I would like to ask you is, you know, what do you think would be the best legacy that we can leave for future students of Iranian studies?
Working together, being open-minded, being flexible all the time, being part of larger working groups and being part of larger corporations, and always highlighting competence on the one hand, but the fascination of a larger picture that is relevant for contemporary times, but also relevant for more ancient times.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. I mean, this was such a pleasure, and I was really looking forward to this conversation. And so obviously we hope that you will not only come visit us here in Los Angeles again, but just please come back and, you know, grace us with your wisdom on the podcast again at some point in the future.
No, yeah, Lexi, I have to thank you. You did this in a just a wonderful way. I enjoyed it very much talking with you. It was really, really, really a pleasure, and I think you are doing a great job. Thank you so much for this.
Legacies of Ancient Persia is a Port of Oud podcast production hosted and edited by Lexi Henning, with select episodes co-hosted by Marissa Stevens. Cover art provided by Hadley Leesman and original music by Brent Arhart. Established in 2017 as the premier research center for the study of ancient Iran, the mission of the Port of Oud Institute for the Study of the Iranian World is to engage in transformative research on all aspects of Iranian antiquity, including its reception in the medieval and modern periods, by expanding on the traditional domains of old Iranian studies and promoting cross-cultural and interdisciplinary scholarship. Thanks for listening to our show. It's available to stream on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow us on social media at Port of Oud Institute and at Port of Oud UCLA. Or visit our website, portofoud.ucla.edu. If you enjoyed today's episode, please give us a 5-star rating and review us. For podcast inquiries or questions about the Port of Oud Institute, please email us at portofoudpodcastproduction@gmail.com. We'll see you next time as we continue our deep dive into the legacies of ancient Persia.